From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Will Joe stay or will he go? Ahead on Only a Game, 44-year Penn State head coach Joe Paterno looks for some job security. Also, Ball State's near-perfect 2008 football season, the Hot Stove League's latest news, and a conversation with Gary Andrew Poole, author of The Galloping Ghost, Red Grange, an American football legend. Also ahead, the 16th annual Only a Game Sports Holiday Gift Guide.
The product is called the Euro Club, and it is a portable urinary device camouflaged as a 7-iron, as a golf club.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. We're helping out the banks and the investment houses, too. We'll no doubt help the automakers. Then, when we are through, perhaps we'll bail out shoe stores and the people who make hankies. But boy, it doesn't look as if we'll have to help the Yankees. Joining me now to discuss one of the few businesses still hiring new employees and giving them unprecedented raises, the aforementioned Yankees, as well as other baseball offseason wheelers and dealers at this week's winter baseball meetings in Las Vegas, is Tim Kirkshen of ESPN and ESPN.com. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. The Yankees, secure in the conviction that their new stadium will bring in vast sums, have offered C.C. Sabathia the largest contract ever offered to a pitcher, $161 million over 7 years. Assuming that he passes his physical, he'll move from very wealthy to incomprehensibly rich, and the Yankees have also reached an agreement with A.J. Burnett, another pitcher. How much more does New York have to do to make the World Series in 2009?
Well, they have quite a few more things to do, Bill, and they are operating, again, on a complete island here. They are different than every major league team out there, including the Red Sox, and they are showing it again here. While every other team out there, almost every team, has a financial issue to deal with, the Yankees have saved money from last year, believe it or not, and they are not going to rest until they get a team that can get them back in the playoffs and maybe get them back in the World Series. C.C. Sabathia is just the start of this. They might sign A.J. Burnett for another $80 to $85 million to fortify their rotation. After that, they may go get another starting pitcher, whether it's Derek Lowe, who's going to come at a very stiff price, or Ben Sheets, who's also going to be very expensive. And then they're going to turn to look at their everyday lineup, which needs some work also, and they're going to spend a lot of money there also. Because, again, the Steinbrenner boys are in charge of this team. They're opening a new stadium. They're embarrassed about what happened last year. They are completely desperate, and they will spend whatever it takes to make them good again.
Mark Teixeira was thought to be more likely to go to the Red Sox than the Yankees, but yesterday there was speculation that New York might get him, too. Did the Steinbrenner brothers discover more gold buried under the construction site, or what?
Well, there's gold there, Bill. Keep in mind that a friend of a friend bought 4 season tickets at the new Yankee Stadium, right behind home plate, you know, basically the 4 best seats in the house. 4 season tickets, he wrote a check for $810,000.
Oh, my God.
$2,500 a seat, 4 seats, that's $10,000 a game, 81 games. That's why the Yankees can go out and spend this kind of money. However, I don't think they're going to get Mark Teixeira. They have whispered to me all along, we can't get Sabathia and Teixeira, and I'm going to take them for their word on that.
Over the latter part of the 08 season, Manny Ramirez did for the Dodgers what C.C. Sabathia did for the Brewers. What's the likelihood that Los Angeles fans get Manny back?
I think it's pretty good. At this point, there still does not appear to be a second team that has any significant interest. My guess is he re-signs with the Dodgers because, again, I don't think there's a second team out there.
Speaking of pitching, as we were a moment ago, Phillies ace Cole Hamels engaged in some trash-talking this week, Tim, appearing on a New York radio station. I think it was the Mets radio station, in fact. He called the Mets, quote, choke artists. So I guess we already know what's going to be on the bulletin board at spring training when the Mets convene in Florida.
the Mets are the wrong team to be messing with right now, frankly, because they've just played horribly down the stretch 2 years in a row. And if they weren't embarrassed enough by 2007, they were by 2008. And way more important than that, they added two really good relief pitchers. Frankie Rodriguez is a free agent. He saved 62 games last year. And they added J.J. Putz in a trade with Seattle, and he's going to pitch the eighth inning, and he's one of the best ninth inning guys in the game. So there's no question the Mets are demonstrably better than they were 2 weeks ago. And if I were Cole Hamels or anyone else, I would not be talking trash with the Mets.
Tim, we can't end this conversation without talking about a pitcher who probably could have signed for lots more millions if he hadn't decided to retire after the 2008 season. With his 355 career wins, where does Greg Maddux stand among the all-time greats?
Bill, I've got him as the seventh best pitcher of all time. Seventh. I'm not sure the average person truly understands how good this guy really was. Keep in mind, he is the greatest control pitcher of his era. He's one of the great control pitchers of all time. He won 15 games for 17 consecutive years. No one else in baseball history ever did that, not even Cy Young. In fact, when he got to 17, the active pitcher with the longest streak, second longest streak at that time, had a four-year streak of 15 wins, and Maddux was at 17. He's one of the most underrated pitchers of all time. I don't think his name comes up nearly often enough when we talk about great, great pitchers.
And if you've got six pitchers ahead of Greg Maddux, I bet very few of them have been as approachable and as humble about what they have accomplished.
Don Sutton told me this story once, that he invited Greg Maddux out for dinner one night on the road to Ruth Chris's Steakhouse. And Greg Maddux said, "Thanks, but I've got a pizza back in my room that I started last night. And I played a video game last night, and I couldn't beat that game. But I'm going back to my room tonight, and I'm not leaving until I beat that video game." That's what he did instead of going out to Ruth Chris's with Don Sutton. That's how Greg Maddux works all the time, ultra competitive, but a guy that just doesn't think all that much of himself until he gets on the hill, and then he knows he's as good a pitcher as almost anyone's seen in the last 40 to 50 years.
Tim Kirchen of ESPN and ESPN.com joins me every so often to talk baseball. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
On New Year's Day, Penn State University will play the University of Southern California in the Rose Bowl. Joe Paterno is recovering from hip replacement surgery, but he hopes to coach the Big Ten champs from the sideline. He'll turn 82 years old next weekend, and Paterno's critics say it might be time for him to think about retirement, but as Joel Rose reports, that seems to be the last thing on Coach Paterno's mind.
Joe Paterno showed he can still fire up the fans at a pep rally on the eve of the team's last regular season game against Michigan State.
"We're going to be a Big Ten champion twice in 4 years. Come on!"
As he spoke, Paterno waved his walking cane wildly in the air, which only made the crowd scream louder. Paterno injured his hip while demonstrating an onside kick during practice, but he promised he won't need the cane next fall.
"But I've walked out on that stadium when I could run out on that field, which I will do next year. Run out on that field."
Next season would be Paterno's 44th as the head coach at Penn State. It's a milestone that seemed unreachable just a few years ago. After Penn State endured a stretch of three losing seasons in 4 years, plenty of people were screaming for Paterno to step down.
"Through all that, Joe was alone in thinking that things could turn around."
Philadelphia Inquirer sports writer Frank Fitzpatrick wrote about Paterno and the team's 2004 season in his book, The Lion in Autumn.
"There weren't sports writers. I doubt there were assistant coaches. I don't think there were fans that thought things were going to turn around. Certainly not without Joe leaving and that quickly. Joe, throughout that entire season, kept saying, we're only a player or two away. If we get a skilled player here, skilled player there, we can turn this thing around. People thought he was crazy."
But as Paterno told his fans at the pep rally last month, he didn't give up.
"When we were having our troubles and everybody thought Penn State football had had its day, we made up our minds that we were all right. We were okay. And that team, the next year, won the Big Ten championship. And they've been to three bowls since. And by God, we're going to win a Big Ten championship tomorrow."
Sure enough, Penn State routed Michigan State to win its second Big Ten title in 4 years. And these days, critics are a lot tougher to find. The website firejoepaterno.com hasn't been updated in years. Sports writer Frank Fitzpatrick says hardly anyone in State College, Pennsylvania, is calling for Paterno to retire. But Fitzpatrick says there are those who'd like to see a succession plan in place.
At some point, Penn State's going to need a new coach. And I think they're worried that when he leaves, there's going to be chaos. What's going to happen to the program? Who's going to recruit? Right now, Joe's face is the thing carrying that program.
Joe Pa, as he's affectionately known, was born in Brooklyn. He came to Penn State as an assistant coach in 1950 and took over as head coach 16 years later. He's won more bowl games and more football games, period, than any coach in Division I-A college football history. Off the field, Paterno and his wife have donated millions of dollars to the university, and they helped raise $13 million more to build the library wing that bears his name. After talking to students there, it's pretty clear that Paterno still has a lot of support.
I love Joe Pa. He's like our mascot. He's almost as important as the Nittany Lion. Like, when he's not there, it's just, like, sad.
Yeah, he's old and all, but I think at this point, especially to get rid of him, I just don't think it would be a good idea. You know, as long as he can, you know, continue to stay in good health and stick around and put up wins, you know, I don't see any problem with him staying.
Being, what was that, Big Ten champions or freshman and senior years, like, he's obviously doing something right, so more power to him.
The voices of senior Marissa Brody, junior Marcus Waters, and senior Samantha DeFernanda. But that kind of support isn't quite unanimous. Junior Jessica Norris.
I've watched the games, and especially the most recent games, he's been sitting up in the, like, box the whole time. It doesn't even seem like he's a part of the coaching staff anymore. He doesn't even wear a little headset anymore. He's not communicating with anything. He's just like a figurehead for recruiting.
Paterno's supporters say he's more than just a figurehead. But even Paterno admits that he delegates more responsibility than he used to. Here he is in August of 2007 speaking with interviewer Charlie Rose.
The old days, I used to try to do it all by myself. I'm not that. I can't do that physically. I'm not the same football coach I was 15 years ago. And I'd be foolish if I thought I was. But whether I'm effective or not, you know, obviously I think I am.
Paterno's future is a subject the university doesn't like to discuss. His current contract will expire at the end of the season. The athletic department declined our request for an interview. Penn State President Graham Spanier and athletic director Tim Crowley have said they won't talk about Paterno's status until the season is over. But sports writer Frank Fitzpatrick thinks the decision may not be theirs to make.
He's got such a legacy there that there's no one powerful enough to tell him what to do. And unless Joe wants to go, it's not going to happen. Joe's going to be there as long as he wants to be there.
And that could be a while, as Paterno told Charlie Rose last year.
I feel great. You know, I get up in the morning, I thoroughly enjoy coaching. As long as I feel that way about it, I'm going to coach.
Whatever happens in the Rose Bowl, don't be surprised to see Joe Pa leading his team back onto the field at Beaver Stadium next fall without the cane. For Only a Game, I'm Joel Rose in State College, Pennsylvania.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. If a masked man trying to steal a bag of money from a woman outside a bank in Happy Valley, Pennsylvania, were to be tackled and dragged to the ground, how surprised would anyone be? Penn State, the legendary football school, is located in Happy Valley, Pennsylvania. People there probably run into current and former linebackers and safeties all the time. You'd have to be an idiot to try stealing a bag of money there. But when a 50-year-old man, in this case William Roger Onstott, brings down a robber in Happy Valley, Oregon, that's news because the University of Oregon isn't there. Neither is Oregon State, let alone Penn State, and neither are the universities of Nebraska, Michigan, or Texas. So how do you suppose this fellow Onstott did it? I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the life of football phenom Red Grange. But first, on December 5th, the eyes of Muncie, Indiana, were on the Mid-American Conference Championship game in Detroit, where the Ball State Cardinals hoped to run their 2008 winning streak to 13-0. Alas, the Buffalo Bulls spoiled Ball State's plans for perfection, though the Cardinals will get to face off against Tulsa in the GMAC Bowl on January 6th. Here to discuss the Cardinals' successful football season is Doug Zaleski of the Muncie Star Press. Doug, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
In what ways did the population of Muncie, collegiate or otherwise, respond as Ball State burned through their 2008 schedule on the way to a perfect regular season?
You know what? I think it started slowly. I think the expectation this year was that Ball State would have a good season, maybe win 9 or 10 games. And as this thing got rolling back in September with wins over Navy and a win at Indiana, which was a big deal for Ball State being here in Indiana, to beat Indiana, first time in school history, first time they'd ever beaten a Big Ten team, the motion of the season really kind of got underway then, and it just really carried through. And by November, the community here was really involved in the football season. This is a basketball area. Everybody knows about Indiana, the movie Hoosiers, Bobby Knight. The student enrollment here just took off unbelievably. There's 17 or 18,000 students at Ball State, and at their last home game, there were 11,000 students in attendance at the game, so well more than half of the student enrollment showed up for the game on the night that they could have gone home for Thanksgiving break.
Tell me a little bit about the composition of this team and why it was so special, aside from the obvious fact that it kept winning football games.
The main reason Ball State was 12-0, and I think everybody here, everybody in the Mid-American Conference would agree, they have a special quarterback. And some of your listeners would probably recognize names like Chad Pennington, who played for the Jets for a long time, is now with the Dolphins. Ben Roethlisberger, who led the Steelers to the Super Bowl championship a couple of years ago. Ball State's quarterback is a guy named Nate Davis, and he's kind of in the mold of those guys. He's a strong-armed quarterback, a tremendous passer, great confidence, very mobile. He's destined for the NFL. He's a junior. He may come out for the NFL draft next spring. That remains to be seen at this point, but it could happen, and he's really the guy that they've attached their wagon to.
Ball State's most famous alumnus, David Letterman, led the cheers from the East Coast all season, of course, where he does his late-night television show, and he even honored the school with a top 10 list, top 10 highlights of the Ball State Cardinals football season presented by head coach Brady Hoke, and what a good sport he must have been to go along with this.
Yeah, you know, he's kind of a low-key guy. He was in a suit and tie. He doesn't wear a tie very often, so he looked pretty stiff to me, and I'm sure he was a little bit uneasy appearing on national television, but he did a pretty good job. And number one on that list was the drunk 3 a.m. coaching tips from Letterman.
That was pretty good. I like number two, which was none of our players shot themselves in the leg. I thought that was especially good. But my very favorite was number three, which reads like this. Ball State beat Eastern Michigan, Central Michigan, Western Michigan, Southern Michigan, Southwestern Michigan, and Mexican Michigan. Ball State didn't really play Mexican Michigan, did they?
They did not, surprisingly. they did, however, play the first three teams on that list. Eastern Michigan, Central Michigan, Western Michigan are all West Division opponents of Ball State in the MAC, but there is no Southern Michigan, Southwestern Michigan, and to the best of my knowledge, I won't swear 100% to this, but to the best of my knowledge, there is no Mexican Michigan.
Having the kind of season that Ball State has had, there are mixed blessings associated with this. We spoke of head coach Brady Hoke. He's now being considered for top jobs at Auburn or perhaps San Diego State. What are the chances that Hoke will remain at Ball State?
Well, I said after the season that I thought there was a 50-50 chance that he would remain at Ball State. You know, he's a Ball State guy. He played here. He graduated from Ball State. His wife is a Ball State graduate. He's from the Dayton, Ohio area, which is 90 minutes from here. And I thought all along that that there'd be a reasonable chance that he would remain here next year. I think what he would really like to do is beef up his resume a little bit over the next year or two. He's in year six here. This is really the first great success he's had. He had losing seasons each of his first 4 years. 2007, they went 7-6. They played in a bowl game, lost to Rutgers in the International Bowl in Toronto. And I think that he believes if he stays around, has some success in the next year or two, that overall resume will really be sparkled up a little bit, and he'd be much more attractive for some of these upper-tier coaching openings that come available every year.
Will the denizens of Muncie, Indiana, be muttering under their breath as they watch the GMEC Bowl? Because it's kind of considered a secondary bowl, especially given the way GM is going these days. Or will said denizens just be happy their team is at a bowl game?
You know, if you're Ball State, you don't go to a bowl game every year. This will be their second straight year with a bowl game. But previous to this, they had only played three bowl games in their history as a team from the top level of the NCAA. I think the fact that it's a warm weather site maybe enhances it a little bit for the Ball State fan. They're going to Mobile, Alabama, where it ought to be about 60 degrees on January 6th, and you've got beaches on the ocean 30 minutes away, and you've got outdoor activities. Mardi Gras was actually born in Mobile, Alabama, so there's a little bit of history there, a little something to do. There's outdoor activities. I think the Ball State fan would embrace that atmosphere.
Well, I hope the Bon Temps will rouler when they get there.
Oui, oui. That's the extent of my French. Oui, oui.
It was masterfully handled. Doug Zaleski covers Ball State athletics for the Muncie Star Press and the Indy Star. Doug, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
To experience Only a Game's magical web world, please visit onlyagame.org. How good a football player was Red Grange? Good enough to have scored 5 touchdowns for Illinois against Michigan in 1924. Good enough to have not only run for touchdowns, passed for touchdowns, returned kicks and punts for touchdowns, and caught passes for touchdowns, but also to have made tackles on defense and, in a pinch, to have kicked as well. He was also good enough to have carried an entire pro league on his shoulders, at least for one season. Gary Andrew Poole, the author of The Galloping Ghost, Red Grange, an American Football Legend, joins me now from NPR West to discuss the man who may have been the best there ever was at football. Gary, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, it's great to be on the show. Thanks for having me, Bill.
First of all, did I exaggerate in that introduction?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, ESPN earlier this year named Grange the greatest ever college football player. He was an outstanding player on the field. But as I detail in my book, it was really his decisions off the field which really had a great impact on the game as well.
Let's stick with the college career for just a little while because it was so spectacular. Of all the things Red Grange accomplished as a college football player between 1923 and 1925, what most impressed you?
Well, I mean, first of all, it was his consistency, and it was also his ability to rise up in the biggest of games. Most football fans know about the game against Michigan where he scored the 4 touchdowns in the first 12 minutes of the game and later went on to, in that same game, throw a touchdown as well as run another one in and have a couple interceptions. And many historians consider that one of the greatest individual performances. But I'd like to point people to a game against the University of Pennsylvania, which he had in his senior year, where he really didn't have a very good team around him. And he went to Penn, which was, believe it or not, Bill, a powerhouse back in the 1920s. he was really expected not to do much, Grange, that day, because the Quakers were so good and the field conditions were so poor. If you look at the photographs, mud was practically up to the players' knees that day. And Grange took it to him. He ran for 360-odd yards and a few touchdowns. And really, I mean, just like a Tiger Woods or a Michael Phelps, I mean, Grange could raise his game in the biggest of games and the biggest of spectacles. And that really is often what makes a legend.
The players in the 20s were not nearly as well protected as college and pro players are today. And in some cases, the play was a good deal rougher. The officials let more things go. But I didn't realize until I read your book how often players would get bitten.
Yeah, that's true. It was a rough game, especially in the piles. It was a dangerous game. I mean, Grange's father really didn't want him to play football. When Grange was a kid, there were a lot of football deaths at the beginning of the last century, and a lot of people felt that football should be outlawed because of the danger of the game.
As great as Red Grange was at Illinois, his coach urged him to find something other than pro football when it came time to leave school. Why was that?
Well, pro football was really looked upon as a sort of a shady enterprise. If you opened up the newspaper in, say, circa 1923, the fall of 1923, you'd see a lot of college football coverage. You'd see a lot of pro baseball coverage. The NFL was sort of a podunk enterprise, almost an embarrassment. And college football was really seen as a maker of men. I mean, you went and played college football, and then you went off after you graduated, and you led businesses, you led armies, you might even lead nations. I mean, if you look at Theodore Roosevelt or a Ronald Reagan or a Nixon or an Eisenhower, I mean, these were all guys that played college football and then went on to great political careers. And that was sort of the ideal. I mean, it was an amateur ideal. So his coach, a guy named Bob Zubke, was really against Grange joining this sort of, you know, if it wasn't prohibition, I guess it would be called a beer league back then. I mean, there really weren't too many people coming to games. And the level of play was not high either. But Grange decided to turn pro for a variety of reasons, mostly because he needed the money.
With the assistance of a con artist named C.C. Pyle, Red Grange embarked on a barnstorming football tour that required him to play as many as three or four games a week. Why did anybody think that was a good idea?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it was a grueling tour. But his manager, a guy named C.C. Pyle, whose nickname was Cash and Carry, because he always wanted the cash up front, hooked up with Grange, and he came up with a plan. Let's take pro football on the road. And, you know, he signed Grange with the Chicago Bears, and they went on this grueling tour. And the good idea of it was that Grange made a lot of money. Back in the 20s, players were making, you know, $100, maybe $200 a game. Grange was clearing with his manager, you know, $15,000 to $30,000 a game. This was an astounding amount of money, and Grange was making more money than Babe Ruth or even the president.
Well, as you say, the tour was profitable for Grange, and certainly it enhanced the profile of pro football. People who had never given pro football a thought suddenly had it in their neighborhoods. But is it accurate to say that the adventure also wrecked Grange as a player?
Yes, I think so. He had already played a college season, and it was cold out there. These are the winter months, and Grange was required by his contract to play most of the game, and it really wore him out. Grange was not a guy who complained much, but later in life he really said that this tour ruined him. He was really never the same player again. And George Halas, the owner of the Chicago Bears, and Pyle just really drove him relentlessly, I think.
I'm speaking with Gary Andrew Poole, the author of The Galloping Ghost. You're listening to Only a Game. Would Red Grange have been better off if he'd never met C.C. Pyle and if he'd simply gone from college into the pros as another football player?
Well, that's a fascinating question to me. I don't think so. I mean, Grange was an enormously popular college player, but Pyle had you called him a con man, but he was really brilliant in his ability to promote Red Grange. And I don't think Red Grange would have been forgotten. He would have probably still been seen as the greatest ever college football player. But he really stayed in people's minds because Pyle, you know, put him on this barnstorming tour. Even if he would have gone pro without the aid of C.C. Pyle, I don't think he would have had quite as interesting of a time of it. I doubt if he would have been making movies and had all these endorsement deals. I don't know if he would have been meeting the president, spending time with starlets, that sort of thing. So I don't know if he would have had as interesting of a time.
Red Grange lived to be 87. He died in 1991. And of the many years that followed his football career, you write, quote, "The galloping ghost spent the rest of his life reliving 4 years of his life," those 4 years being his college career and perhaps his first year as a pro. As you finished writing the book, did this strike you as sad?
Well, that's the lot of an athlete, I think. I don't know if it was sad. I mean, at the end of his life, he always said, if I wouldn't have tried out for that high school team, my life wouldn't have been as interesting. And so I don't know if he saw it as sad. When he was older, he was out giving speeches, talking about these significant games in the 20s, this four-year span. When reporters would come to his Florida home, he was answering the same questions over and over again. And he answered the same questions over and over again, really, the rest of his life.
Gary Poole is the author of The Galloping Ghost, Red Grange, an American football legend, published by Houghton Mifflin. He joined me from the studios of NPR West. Gary, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, great questions. Thanks for having me on.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
According to NASHI, Russia's pro-government youth group, which is organizing the Miss Constitution 2008 pageant, the winning candidate will be attractive, talented, and witty. More significantly, she will symbolize the Russian Constitution, the 15th anniversary of which will be celebrated in 2 days. The Constitution is a state brand, and we want a girl worth its image, said a NASHI spokeswoman this week. The girls must prove they are clever, erudite, artistic, graceful, flexible, and most important of all, not without sparkle. Not without sparkle? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, gift suggestions ranging from the silly to the spectacular for the sports fans on your list. And wait till you hear about gnome bowling. First, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
What happens when you throw a gutter ball?
Oh, you'll see. It's just priceless. This week, the National Football League announced staffing cuts. The NFL has long been known as one of the world's most profitable sports operations. Were you surprised by the announcement?
I'll be honest with you. This is the single most frightening story that's come out of the economic meltdown so far, that the National Football League is laying people off. I mean, this is a $6.5 billion industry. That's laying off 10% of its staff. And that's just remarkable to me.
Major League Baseball also announced this week that they will trim the staff by about 20. The NBA pink slipped 80 people earlier this year. Given the trend, to what extent are less successful pro leagues and minor leagues in trouble?
Well, I think it's fascinating, number one, that the only one of the major leagues that hasn't laid anybody off is the NHL, which you would figure is the most perilous.
Probably down to the bone already.
Well, I was going to say, they probably only have 20 people working in the league office anyway. But you're also seeing, of course, the ripple effects. Arena football, one of my own personal hobby horses, is probably on the way out for keeps. They need a lot of money by December 19th, and they're not going to get it. So,
all the economic bad news notwithstanding, the market for college bowl games continues to be bullish, and now we finally know who's going to play in the alleged national championship bowl, right?
That we do. It's good. To nobody's real surprise, I don't think, Florida and Oklahoma, which may or may not be a good game. I think Oklahoma could beat them like a drum. It is nice, though, to see some mystery guests in our bowl schedule this year. Troy will be playing in the RNL Carriers New Orleans. I don't know if Coach Priam and quarterback Hector will be up for their first bowl game.
I certainly hope so.
But we have Memphis at the Magic Small M Capital Jack St. Petersburg Bowl playing South Florida. Some of these companies, man, you're going to be facing the Al's Bar and Grill Sun Bowl at some point. It's right now down. It's the Brute Sun Bowl, and I haven't heard Brute mentioned since 1975.
No, long time. It is Heisman weekend, Charlie, so...
Excuse me. Thank
brilliantly
you.
Struck, a pose brilliantly struck, statuesque as always. So who takes the award for Best College Football Player of 2008?
For a long time, I was resisting this possibility, but I think Tim Tebow is going to win his second in a row. I think there's been a late rush of support for him, given what Florida has been able to do in the last month. He's in the national championship game. I don't think Sam Bradford of Oklahoma has the profile, and Colt McCoy just about a step behind him, I think.
In pro football, the incident in which Plaxico Burress of the New York Giants accidentally shot himself in the leg in a nightclub back on November 29th continues to grab headlines. Burress has been charged with criminal possession of a handgun. He's been suspended by the Giants, which the NFL Players Association says is inappropriate. Do you agree?
I'd have to know the ins and outs of the collective bargaining agreement to know for sure, but it does seem to me that the Giants did act precipitously, but on the other hand, it seems like an event to which precipitous action might well be a proper response.
This week, pitcher C.C. Sabathia agreed to a deal with the New York Yankees that will potentially pay him $161 million. There were reports that Sabathia was concerned that he and his family might not like living in New York, and so his contract addresses that possibility rather creatively, don't you think?
Actually, it's a very interesting clause dropped in there because it really does sort of benefit both teams if you look at it the right way. He can opt out of the deal after 3 years, which means the Yankees can unload his salary. If he comes to New York and all those innings he's pitched finally catch up on them, in 3 years, he can opt out or they can find a way for him to opt out. I think this was a kind of a masterpiece of creative financing here.
Kevin McHale took over as coach for the Minnesota Timberwolves this week. This team has been losing more than four-fifths of its games. And McHale said this week, quote, there's still time to rally and get going. Is he dreaming?
He is dreaming. This is a remarkable story where Kevin McHale has got to now take responsibility for everything Kevin McHale's done for the franchise. If there has been a worse major sports executive than Kevin McHale, I do not understand why this guy isn't selling apples outside the arena in Minneapolis at this point. He screwed the team up for 5 years by tinkering with the salary cap and getting caught. He traded Kevin Garnett to his old friend for practically nothing. He's still got a team that can't hit free throws. The team is very bad. He's not much of a coach, let alone much of a general manager. The continued employment remains a mystery.
Of her experience on the golf course last weekend, Michelle Wee said, quote, I took my medicine. Said medicine appears to have worked the cure. Wee has re-earned her LPGA Tour card. So do you agree with me that this is precisely how she should have proceeded?
Well, I mean, it's the way she had to proceed, and I congratulate her for going to Q School and doing the Q School thing and getting through. But now, as near as I can tell from all the coverage of her coming out of the Q School, all the nonsense that forced her into the Q School in the first place is back!
Well, all we can do is hope that as she is a little bit older, and perhaps a little bit wiser, that won't be the case.
The only thing I would really take to the bank in that regard is we could prove she's been adopted by another family while she was in Q School.
And finally, Charlie, having refused to submit a urine sample for a drug test at the Chess Olympiad in Dresden, Grandmaster Vasily Ivanchuk is now considered guilty of doping. No wonder they call him Big Chucky, huh?
Big Chucky! Who are you playing in the first round of the tournament? Big Chucky! Big Chucky don't pee in front of folks, not Big Chucky. Now Big Chucky gonna be playing underground chess. Big Chucky.
What do you take to dope in chess?
No dose?
That's for fans.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, boy, the letters we'll get for that one. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. Of course, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
I used to be Big Chucky, but I'm not anymore.
I'm just a humble radio host, born in the days when enraptured families sat together before the softly glowing Philco set. Your modern world of streaming media and MP3s frightens and confuses me, but that doesn't mean you have to feel the same way. To access podcasts of Only a Game, please go to onlyagame.org. Listen carefully. Just beneath the jingle of the bells and the jolly carolers begging lustily for figgy pudding, are those the mid-December strains of anxiety, desperation, and panic? Don't cover your ears. There's hope even now, as the days before the holidays dwindle down to a precious few, assuming some of the people for whom you have not yet found gifts are sports fans. The 16th annual Only a Game Holiday Gift Guide is just what you've been waiting for.
Roll, roll, roll your ball gently
roll,
down the lane.
Roll your ball
merrily, merrily, merrily now.
Merrily, merrily, merrily now.
And even if you aren't ready for the latest plethora of possible presents, here comes John Mitchley, Managing Director of BV Leisure in Great Britain, with Gnome Bowling.
The Brits have this ridiculous sense of humor where they're infatuated by these gnomes. They either have them in the garden, they have them lit up, they have them inside. So we put them in a box, six of them, brightly coloured, plastic moulded, 10 inches high, two bowling balls, 6 inches in diameter, and you just bowl them over as much as you can.
There are only six gnomes in a set, as Mr. Mitchley maintains that 10 would have just been too frightening.
Over three rivers and through the town to the stadium we go.
Football fans, especially football fans who root for a team other than the one favored by their spouses, might want to consider a house-divided flag. Stephanie Jeffers spoke with me about that product, which is a banner made up of the colors and logos of two college teams, preferably two rivals. Ms. Jeffers also explained how, as a Nebraska fan married to a fan of Texas Tech, necessity was the mother of the invention of the house-divided flag.
When my husband and I got married, both being rabid football fans, we recognized right off the bat that our problem wasn't going to be dirty laundry on the floor or anything like that. It was going to be the competition we found ourselves in every Saturday when it was during football season.
So is it safe to say that you would be divorced if it weren't for this innovation in married couple rooting?
I'd like to think that our union is a little stronger than that. But it certainly has helped.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me.
Saved marriages bring to mind romance. And romance was on the mind of Katie Mossich when she came up with collegiate fragrances, perfumes, suitable for fans of various football teams.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely looked at the school colors and we said, okay, for example, if you think about University of Alabama, what are red arombanics for that Crimson Tide? You think berry, pomegranate, apple. We looked at campus flowers and trees. We looked at the school architecture and the landmark style.
So a great football university wouldn't necessarily smell like a football.
No, but I have got that question. And I also have gotten beer, and I've gotten, does it smell like sweaty football players? And I said no, but I hope that many sweaty football players are wearing this fragrance because they'll love it.
She's candy apple red with the ski for a wheel. And with Santa hits the gas, just watch her.
If you're looking for a gift likely to produce aromas of a different sort altogether, you might want to consider the Manifold Destiny Cookbook. Written by Bill Scheller and Chris Maynard, it tells you all you need to know about cooking everything from ham steak to stuffed eggplant on your car engine while you're driving. We are a sports show, so I couldn't resist asking Bill Scheller if he'd sent copies of the book to anybody at the racetrack.
Well, we haven't sent it to NASCAR, and I don't know to what extent it's been brought to the attention of the big three, but Chris and I were talking the other day about how nice it would have been to have had a little advance notice when these guys hopped in their cars and drove from Detroit to Washington. Because it would have been great if they had cooked, you know, as I say, a ham steak some nice slices of pork tenderloin. They could have passed it around and put the senators in a good mood.
I think you guys have missed a great big bet with NASCAR. I mean, talk about fast food.
Well, you know, it would be a whole different division. You could run the races in terms of points for the best dish presented at the end, as well as who got across the finish line.
Exactly.
First.
Wouldn't matter if you finished first if your souffle had fallen.
Oh, souffles are tricky. You've got to have really good suspension for souffles.
Whatever you might think about cooking on your car engine, who can deny that it's practical? And in that vein, another referral is perhaps in order.
My name is Floyd E. Seskin, M.D. I'm a urologist in South Florida. The product is called the UroClub. That's UROCLUB.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a portable urinary device camouflaged as a 7-iron, as a golf club.
Uh-huh.
After operating on a man for an enlarged prostate, I had a guy come back to me after several months from this procedure, and he says, I'm feeling great, I'm sleeping all night long, and you improved my golf game. And he said, of course, you know, there aren't many bathrooms on the golf course. I would purposely hit my ball into the woods just so I could urinate. He goes, I developed a wonderful slice on purpose.
Male golfers may be yearning for the Euro Club, but I had to ask Dr. Seskin if he'd been able to do anything for female golfers.
Almost half my patients are women, and I know how they urinate. Women are never going to drop their panties in the middle of the course and urinate into this. I would need an entire pop-out tent to pop out of their bag, along with somebody to accompany them to the bathroom for them to use something like this.
It was the night before Hanukkah. Wojcik's and Mädels, not a sound could be heard, not even the dreidels.
Games can make great gifts, a fact not lost on Jenny Rivlin Roberts of ModernTribe.com. She offers a new twist on an old tradition.
What is No Limit Texas Dreidel? It's a cross between traditional Hanukkah dreidel game and Texas Hold'em poker. So the objective of the game is to create your best hand of 5 dreidel spins. So you're playing with dreidels instead of cards.
How, I wondered, had Ms. Roberts come up with the idea?
The game was invented largely because I was so frustrated about dreidel. And everybody makes fun of dreidel. It is. It's just lame. And it's we would always have Hanukkah parties for our adult friends, and we'd always have dreidels. But when our Gentile friends would look at the dreidel and say, you know, how do you play this? We'd be like, don't worry about it. Just eat the chocolate gilt.
Should you be in the market for something high-tech, Jonathan Huberman of iOmega hopes you'll think it would be fun to accessorize the computer of somebody on your gift list by attaching it to a 250-gigabyte backup drive embossed with the logo of the New England Patriots. With all those NFL teams to choose from, including the defending champion New York Giants, I wondered why Mr. Huberman and his colleagues had chosen to decorate their product as they did.
Well, we were talking to a number of teams right at the beginning of the season, and in week one, when Tom Brady went down, we thought, what better symbol for requiring a backup than the New England Patriots?
You may be the only person in the country who benefited from Tom Brady going down in week one.
Well, a lot of other teams did.
If you're feeling charitable toward four-legged critters this holiday season, you might want to send someone on your list a bottle or two of wine from the Victory Dogs Wine Collection. V-I-C-K-T-O-R-Y. Proceeds from each bottle benefit the dogs that were rescued from Michael Vick's Bad News Kennels and fund organizations working to eliminate dog fighting. And if your charitable intentions are a little more ambitious, have we got the guy for you.
This is Pat Patey, and I'm the public relations manager for the Salvation Army here in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex.
Each year, Neiman Marcus publishes their Christmas catalog and puts a number of fantasy gifts in there. And one of the fantasy gifts that's in there this year is the entire end zone from Texas Stadium, this being the last year that the Cowboys will play there. So I hope that between now and the end of the season, someone will get really excited about that, because Jerry Jones, the owner of the Cowboys, is going to be donating the entire purchase price of that back to the Salvation Army.
Mr. Patey guesses that there must be lots of children out there who'd enjoy not only sleeping under the stars, but sleeping on the stars that festoon said end zone. And he's prepared to make the case that even in these hard times, this gift is worth every penny.
So I know $500,000 sounds like a lot of money, but...
Yes, it certainly does.
You know, but imagine the money a person could save by not having to have their yard mowed anymore.
Fantastic. Now, the only worry that I have here is, you know, I know a little bit about the Salvation Army. You're going to need a big kettle.
Well, you're right. We're going to need a big kettle. But, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And we'll figure out a way to accept that donation and to put it to good use.
Whether or not you've completed your holiday shopping, we at Only a Game trust that you, too, will figure out a way to enjoy the season. We certainly hope that will be the case. Happy holidays.
I'd like to fix this bag of tricks and hand them out with a fleeting greeting. Smiles for the frowners, salutes to the uppers, boosts for the downers. May the day be the bowl of cherriest. And to all the merriest, hope you swing during the season. Hope the days go great. Hope you find plenty of reason the whole year long to celebrate.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Erica Bailey, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to learn more about the sports items in our 16th annual gift guide, and even some sports gifts we didn't include, download our weekly podcasts or listen to stories past and present, then please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Euro Club inventor Dr. Floyd E. Seskin.
I've got a great sense of humor. I understand it's got a great gag potential.
You think?
I miss a little bit.
Now, you can almost hear me thinking, should I say just a wee bit? Nah, too easy. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
The groaners make the day, nothing can compare, yes. Have the most, the merriest. Have the most, the merriest.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.